Toxin by Robin Cook. Continued. Cassette 6, Side 1. The sound of the footsteps stopped. Kim could hear the man cursing. Then the footfalls recommenced, increasing in intensity until they stopped just outside the door. Kim held his breath. He gripped the broom handle harder. For an agonizing moment, nothing happened. Then he saw the door handle begin to turn. The man was coming in. Kim's heart raced. The door was yanked open. As soon as Kim sensed the man was starting in, he gritted his teeth and swung the broom at chest height with all the strength he could muster. By chance, he hit the man full in the face, knocking him back through the door. The surprise and the force of the impact dislodged the knife, and it tumbled to the floor. Still holding the broom in his left hand, Kim leaped for the knife. He seized it, only to discover it was a flashlight, not a knife. "Freeze!" a voice commanded. Kim straightened up and looked into the blinding glare of another flashlight. Instinctively, he raised his hand to shield his eyes. Now he could make out the man on the floor. It wasn't the Mexican, but rather a man dressed in a brown Higgins and Hancock shirt. It was a security guard, and he had both hands clasped to his face. Blood was coming out of his nose. "Drop the broom," a voice behind the glare commanded. Kim let go of both the flashlight and the broom. Both fell to the floor with a clatter. The bright beam of the flashlight was lowered, and to Kim's utter relief, he found himself facing two uniformed policemen. The one without the flashlight was holding his pistol in both hands, pointed directly at Kim. "Thank God," Kim managed, despite looking down the barrel of a gun less than 10 feet away. "Shut up," the policeman with the gun commanded. "Get out here and face the wall." Kim was only too happy to comply. He stepped out of the storeroom and put his hands against the wall, as he'd seen done in movies. "Frisk him," the policeman said. Kim felt hands run up and down his arms, legs, and torso. "He's clean. Turn around." Kim did as he was told, keeping his hands raised to avoid any confusion as to his intentions. He was close enough to read the officer's name tags. The man with the gun was Douglas Foster. The other was Leroy McHalverson. The security guard had gotten up and was dabbing at his newly bent nose with a handkerchief. The metal portion of the whisk had hit him with enough force to break it. "Cuff him," Douglas said. "Hey, hold on," Kim said. "I'm not the one you should be cuffing." "Really?" Douglas questioned superciliously. "Who would you suggest?" "There's someone else in here," Kim said. "A dark, wiry-looking guy with tattoos and a huge knife."
"And wearing a hockey mask, no doubt," Douglas said, scoffingly. "And his name is Jason."
"I'm serious," Kim said. "The reason I'm here is because of a woman named Marcia Baldwin." The two policemen exchanged glances.
"Honest," Kim maintained.
"She's a USDA inspector. She was here doing some work. I was talking with her by phone when someone surprised her. I heard breaking glass and a struggle. When I got here looking for her to help her, I was attacked by a man with a knife, presumably the man who attacked Miss Baldwin."
The policeman remained skeptical.
"Look, I'm a surgeon at the University Med Center," Kim said. He fumbled in the pocket of his soiled white coat. Douglas's grip on his pistol tightened. Kim produced his laminated hospital ID card and handed it to Douglas. Douglas motioned for Leroy to take it.
"It looks authentic," Leroy said after a quick inspection.
"Of course it's authentic," Kim said.
"Have you doctors given up on personal hygiene?" Douglas asked.
Kim ran a hand through his scruffy beard and glanced down at his dirty coat and scrubs. He'd not showered, shaved, or changed clothes since early Friday morning.
"I know I look a little worse for wear," he said. "There's an explanation. But for the moment, I'm more concerned about Miss Baldwin and the whereabouts of that man with a knife."
"What about it, Kurt?" Douglas asked the security man. "Was there a woman USDA inspector here, or a strange, dark, tattooed man?"
"Not to my knowledge," Kurt said. "At least they didn't come in while I've been on duty. I came on at 3 o'clock this afternoon."
"Sorry, fella," Douglas said to Kim. "Nice try." Then to Leroy he added, "Go ahead and cuff him."
"Wait a sec," Kim said. "There's blood in the other room that I'm afraid might have come from Ms. Baldwin."
"Where?" Douglas asked.
"It's on a grate," Kim said. "I can show you."
"This is a slaughterhouse," Kurt said. "There's always blood."
"This looked like fresh blood," Kim said.
"Cuff him and we'll go see," Douglas said.
Kim allowed his wrists to be handcuffed behind his back. Then he was made to walk ahead of the others the full length of the central aisle of the chill room. In the main boning room, Kurt asked the policeman to wait while he turned off the lights and the conveyor belts. "The man with the knife turned this machinery on," Kim said.
"Yeah, sure he did," Douglas said.
Kim didn't try to argue, nor did he point out the plastic trash barrel, which had rolled against one of the boning tables. He was sure the blood would convince these cops he was telling the truth. Kim directed them to the proper grate. When Kurt shined his flashlight, Kim was disappointed to see that the blood was gone.
"It was here," Kim contended, shaking his head. "Somebody hosed it off."
"Undoubtedly the man with the knife," Leroy said with a chuckle.
"Who else?"
Douglas questioned facetiously.
"Wait a second," Kim said urgently. He was desperate. He had to get them to believe him. "The telephone. She was talking to me on her cell phone. It's in the record room."
"That's creative," Douglas commented. "I have to give you credit for that."
He looked at Kurt.
"Do you think we could take a look? I mean, it's on our way out."
"Of course," Kurt said. While Kurt led the way to the record room with Kim and Douglas in tow, Leroy went out to the squad car to make contact with the station. At the record room threshold, Kurt stepped aside and let the others enter. Once inside, Kim was immediately crestfallen. The chairs had been righted. More important, the phone was gone.
"It was here, I swear," he said, "and a number of these chairs were upended."
"I didn't see any phone when I came in here to investigate the break-in," Kurt said, "and the chairs were as you see them now."
"What about the broken glass door panel?" Kim said excitedly. He pointed at the door to the front hall. "I'm sure that was the shattering noise I heard when I was on the phone with her."
"I assumed the door was just part of the break-in," Kurt said, "along with the window."
"It couldn't be," Kim said. "I broke the window, but the door panel was already broken when I got here. Look, all the glass from the door panel is on the inside. Whoever did it was in the hall."
"Hmm," Douglas said. He stared down at the broken glass at the base of the door. "He does have a point."
"Her car," Kim said, getting another idea. "It has to be outside still. It's a yellow Ford sedan. It's parked at the end of the building."
Before Douglas could respond to this new suggestion, Leroy returned from the squad car. A wry smile lit up his broad face.
"I just got off the radio with the station," he said. "They ran a quick check for me on the good doctor, and guess what? He's got a sheet. He was arrested just last night for trespassing, resisting arrest, striking a police officer, and assault and battery on a fast food manager. Currently, he's out of the slammer on his own recognizance." "My, my," Douglas said. "A repeat offender. Okay, Doc, enough of this nonsense. You're going downtown."
Chapter 15. Sunday, late morning, January 25th. It was deja vu all over again for Kim. He was back in the same courtroom with the same judge. The only real difference was the weather outside. This time there was no sun. The day was cloudy with scattered snow flurries, and Judge Harlow's mood matched the gray day. Kim was seated at a scarred library table alongside Tracy. Standing before them and directly below the bench was Justin Devereaux, a lawyer and longtime friend of Kim's. He was aristocratic in appearance, a Harvard-trained lawyer who'd followed the old adage, "Go West, young man." He'd started what had become one of the largest and most successful law firms in the city. His case success was unrivaled, yet on this particular morning he looked concerned. He'd been fighting an uphill battle against Judge Harlow's ire. Kim looked worse than ever, having spent yet another night in jail in the same outfit. He still hadn't shaved or showered. He was also clearly anxious about the outcome of the current proceedings. The last thing he wanted to do was go back to jail. Justin cleared his throat.
"Allow me to reiterate that Dr. Kim Regis has truly been the proverbial pillar of society up until the tragic affliction of his only daughter."
"His daughter's illness was the excuse for his appearance before this court yesterday, Counselor," Judge Harlow said with impatience. "For my weekend on call, I don't like to see the same face twice. It's an insult to my judgment for having allowed the individual his freedom after the first infraction."
"Dr. Regis's daughter's recent death has caused him monumental stress, Your Honor," Justin persisted.
"That's apparent," Judge Harlow said. "What's in question is whether he is a threat to society in his current state of mind."
"These were aberrant episodes that will not be repeated," Justin asserted.
As you have heard, Dr. Regis is full of remorse for his rash actions. Judge Harlow toyed with his glasses. His eyes wandered to Kim's. He had to admit the man did look penitent, as well as pitiful. The judge looked at Tracy. The woman's presence and testimony had impressed him.
All right, Judge Harlow said. I'll allow bail, but what has swayed me is not your Ivy League bombast, counselor, but rather the fact that Dr. Regis's former wife has graciously consented to come before this court to attest to his character. With my probate experience, I find that a convincing testimonial. $5,000 bail and trial in 4 weeks. Next case.
Judge Harlow struck his gavel and picked up the next set of papers. Excuse me, Your Honor, Justin said. There's no question of flight here, so $5,000 is blatantly excessive. The judge peered down over the tops of his reading glasses. He raised his eyebrows.
I'm going to pretend I didn't hear that, he said, and I advise you not to push your client's luck, counselor. Next case, please.
Justin shrugged and beat a hasty retreat back to Kim and Tracy. After gathering his things, he motioned for them to follow him out of the courtroom. With Justin's help, the bail was quickly posted. In less than a half hour, the group emerged from the courthouse out into the overcast, wintry morning. They paused at the base of the courthouse steps. A few isolated snowflakes drifted down from the sky. At first, I was afraid Harlow wasn't going to give you bail, Justin said. As the judge implied, consider yourself lucky.
Under the circumstances, I have a hard time considering myself lucky, Kim said with little emotion. But thanks for your help. I apologize for getting you out on a Sunday morning.
Glad to do it, Justin said. And I'm terribly sorry about Becky. My heartfelt sympathies to you both. Kim and Tracy echoed their thanks.
Well, I better be going, Justin said. He touched the brim of his hat. I'll see you two. My best to you both at this difficult time.
Justin gave Tracy a peck on the cheek and Kim a handshake before starting off. He got only a few paces away when he stopped.
A word of advice to you, Kim. Don't get arrested again. If you do, I can guarantee you won't get bail. Back-to-back arrests like you've managed obviously puts you in a special category.
I understand, Kim said. I'll be careful. Kim and Tracy watched Justin walk away until he was completely out of earshot. They turned to each other.
Now I want you to tell me really what happened, Tracy said.
I'll tell you as much as I know, Kim said flatly, but I have to get my car. Would you mind giving me a ride out to Higgins and Hancock?
Not at all, Tracy said. I'd planned as much.
We'll talk in the car, Kim said. They started across the street in the direction of the parking lot.
I'm living a nightmare, Kim confessed.
As I said last night, Tracy responded, we both need help, and we might be the only people who can give it to each other. Kim sighed.
It must seem crazy to you that I've plunged headlong into this E. coli crusade. Our daughter is dead, and all I want to do is race around like some cloak-and-dagger sleuth.
He shook his head. All these years, I prided myself on being the strong one, but now I see that, really, you're the one with the inner strength. I know I can't avoid the fact of Becky's death forever, but I just can't look at it now. I hope you can understand that I'm just not ready to deal with it.
Tracy was silent for a while. Then she reached out and put a hand on Kim's arm.
I understand, she said, and I won't rush you. I'll even support you in your quest, but you won't be able to deny Becky's death forever.
Kim nodded his head.
I know, he whispered, and thank you. The ride went quickly. Kim gave Tracy all the details from the time Marcia showed up at his house until the police booked him and put him in jail. When he described the attack by the man with the knife, Tracy was aghast. He even showed her the shallow slice across the top of his hand.
What did this man look like? Tracy asked. She shuddered. She couldn't imagine the horror of being attacked in a dark slaughterhouse.
It happened so fast, Kim said. I wouldn't be able to describe him very well.
Old? Young? Tracy asked. Tall? Short?
For some inexplicable reason, she wanted an image of this individual.
Dark, Kim said. Dark skin, dark hair. I think he was Mexican, or at least Latin American. Slender, but well-muscled. He had a lot of tattoos.
Why didn't you tell all this to Justin? She asked.
What good would it have done? Kim said.
He could have said something to the judge, Tracy persisted.
But it wouldn't have changed anything, Kim maintained. In fact, it might have made things worse. I mean, it sounds so improbable, and I just wanted to get away from there so I could think of what to do.
So you believe Marcia Baldwin is still in Higgins and Hancock? Tracy asked, possibly being held against her wishes.
That or worse, Kim said. If it were human blood I found, she could have been killed.
I don't know what to say, Tracy admitted.
Nor do I, Kim said. I keep hoping she got out. Maybe I should call my answering machine. Maybe she called.
Tracy pulled the phone from its car cradle and handed it to Kim. He dialed and listened. After a couple of minutes, he put the phone back.
Well? Tracy asked.
Kim shook his head dejectedly.
No luck, he said. Just Ginger.
Tell me again exactly what you heard when you were talking with her the last time, Tracy asked.
I heard the sound of breaking glass, Kim repeated. It came right after she said someone was at the door. Then I heard a series of crashes, which I believe were from chairs falling over. I think whoever came through the door chased her out of the room.
And you told all this to the police? Tracy asked.
Of course, Kim said. But a lot of good that did. Yet it's understandable. They think I'm some kind of nut. When I tried to show them the blood, it had been washed away. When I tried to show them her cell phone, it was gone. Even her car wasn't in the parking lot where it had been when I got there.
Could she have taken the phone? Tracy asked. And driven away in the car?
I hope to God she did, Kim said. I hate to think of any alternative, and I feel so responsible. She'd gone there because of me.
You didn't force her to do anything she didn't want to do, Tracy said. In the short time I had with her, I could tell she wasn't the kind of person people could push around. She definitely had a mind of her own.
What I'd like to do is get my hands on the guard, Kim said. He had to know Marcia was there, even though he denied it.
If he lied to the police, he certainly isn't going to tell you anything, Tracy said.
Well, I've got to do something, Kim said.
Do you know anything about her? Tracy asked. Like where she lives, or where she's from, or whether she has any family in the area?
I know almost nothing about her, Kim admitted, except that she's 29 and she went to veterinary school.
Too bad, Tracy commented. It would be a help if you could establish for sure whether or not she's missing. If she is, then the police would have to listen to you.
You just gave me an idea, Kim said. He straightened up from his slouch.
What do you think of my going to Kelly Anderson and getting her to help?
Now that's not a bad idea, Tracy said. The question is, would she do it?
There's no way of knowing unless I approach her, Kim said.
She's caused you enough grief, Tracy said. It seems to me she owes you something.
Gosh, the media could be a big help, Kim said. Not only with the Marcia problem, but also with the whole meat contamination issue.
The more I think about this, the better I like it, Tracy said. Maybe I can help you convince her.
Kim looked appreciatively at his former wife. With the bitterness of the divorce and the rancor of the custody issues, he'd forgotten how warmly attractive she was.
You know, Trace, he said, I'm really thankful that you came to court this morning, and not just because you made the effort to raise the bail. I'm just thankful you're willing to be with me after all that's happened.
Tracy looked over at Kim. The remark was so out of character for him, yet seeing his eyes, she knew he was sincere.
That's a very nice thing to say, she told him.
I mean it, Kim said.
Well, I appreciate your saying it, Tracy said. I can't remember the last time you thanked me for anything. In fact, it must have been before we were ever married.
I know, Kim admitted. You're right. I had a little time to think last night in jail, and I have to say that the events over the last 24 hours, particularly concerning Becky, have opened my eyes.
Opened your eyes to what? Tracy asked.
To what's really important in life, Kim said. I suppose that sounds melodramatic, but I've realized I've made a terrible mistake. I've focused too much on career and competition at the expense of family and us.
I'm impressed to hear you say such a thing, Tracy said.
This did not sound like the Kim she'd divorced.
I'm afraid I've been selfish all my adult life, Kim continued. It's a little ironic, since the whole time I've been hiding behind the facade of the charitable, selfless physician. Like a child, I've needed constant praise and constant reinforcement, and being a surgeon was a perfect fit. All this makes me feel sad and ashamed. It also makes me want to apologize to you and wish I could take back a number of wasted years.
I'm surprised and overwhelmed, Tracy said, but I accept. I'm impressed by your insight.
Thanks, Kim said simply.
He stared out the windshield. They had turned onto the side road and were approaching Higgins and Hancock. The building looked peaceful and clean under the dusting of snow.
Is this it? Tracy asked.
Kim nodded. The entrance to the parking lot is coming up, he said. My car should be right in front of the main door. At least that's where I left it. Tracy turned where Kim indicated. Kim's car was immediately apparent. It was standing in total isolation. There were only two other cars in the lot, but they were all the way at the end of the plant. Marcia's car was parked where those two cars are, Kim mentioned. Maybe there's an employee entrance over there. Tracy pulled up alongside of Kim's car. She stopped and set the emergency brake. Kim pointed to the record room window that he'd smashed to gain entrance into the building. It had been boarded up. He explained to Tracy he'd done it with one of the large rocks lining the parking lot. What's the plan? Tracy asked when Kim paused. Kim sighed. I've got to get to the hospital. Tom's agreed to look in on my patients, but I have to see them too. Then I'll go see Kelly Anderson. I happen to know where she lives. We have some decisions to make concerning Becky, Tracy said. Kim nodded but looked off in the distance. I know it is difficult, Tracy said, but we have to make funeral arrangements. It might even help us accept her death. Kim bit his lip. Anger and denial are part of the grieving process, Tracy said when Kim didn't respond. I'm guilty of using them as well as you, but we do have responsibilities. Kim turned to face Tracy. There were tears in the corners of his eyes. You're right, he admitted. But as I said, I need a little more time because of what's happened. Would it be too much to ask for you to go ahead and make the arrangements without me? I know it's asking a lot. I'll certainly agree to anything you decide, and of course I'll be there for the service. I'd just like to follow up on this Kelly Anderson idea immediately. Tracy tapped her fingers against the steering wheel while she stared at Kim and pondered his request. Her first thought was to say no, to tell him that he was just being selfish again. But then she reconsidered. Although she didn't want to make the arrangements by herself, she knew that the service itself was far more important than making the arrangements. She also recognized that at the moment she was probably more capable than he was. You won't mind what day I pick? Tracy questioned. Or where a service might be? Not at all, Kim said. Whatever you decide. All right, she said. But you have to promise to call me as soon as you get home. I promise, Kim said. He reached over and gave Tracy's forearm a squeeze before getting out of the car. I'll wait to make sure your car starts, Tracy said. Good idea, Kim said. And thanks. He shut the door. He waved before heading over to his car. Tracy waved back and wondered if she was doing the right thing. Kim opened his car door but didn't get right in. He looked at Higgins and Hancock and shuddered at the memory of the previous night. The terror he'd felt running from the man with the knife came flooding back. It was an experience he knew he'd never forget. Kim started to get into the car but hesitated again. For a brief moment, he entertained the idea of talking with the guard on duty to find out how to get in touch with Kurt, the guard from the previous night. But Tracy's admonition immediately came to mind, and Kim decided she was right. If Kurt were willing to lie to the police about Marcia's presence, he certainly wouldn't be apt to tell the truth to Kim, and the fact that he probably was lying meant there was more to this affair than might appear on the surface. Kim's car started with ease, and he waved at Tracy, who waved back before preceding him out of the parking lot. Kim followed at a distance, rethinking their recent conversation. He thought it was ironic that the awful events of the last few days, Becky's death and his having come close to being murdered, could end up making him feel closer to Tracy than he had in years, maybe even ever. They parted company on the freeway. Kim beeped his horn in farewell. Tracy beeped back as she sped away toward her neighborhood. Kim took the exit appropriate for the med center. On Sundays, the doctor's parking lot was almost empty, and Kim was able to park close to the front entrance. As he climbed out of his car, he told himself the first order of business was for him to go directly up to the surgical locker room. He wanted to clean up, shave, and change into the street clothes he'd left there Friday morning. Martha Trumbull and George Constantine were both in their early 70s, and both had been faithful volunteers at the University Medical Center long enough to have been awarded the prestigious Friends of the Hospital Service pins. Martha proudly wore hers on the front of her pink volunteer smock, whereas George wore his on the lapel of his cerulean volunteer blazer. Martha and George's favorite assignment was manning the information desk in the hospital lobby. They particularly liked to work there on Sunday when they had it to themselves. On the other days of the week, a paid hospital employee was in charge. Taking their roles seriously, they not only knew the layout of the hospital with the same detail as the floor plans of their own homes, but they also knew the names of the entire hospital professional staff. When Kim came through the door on his way to the elevator, they both thought they recognized him, yet they weren't 100% certain. Martha glanced at George.
"Is that Dr. Regis?" she whispered.
"I think so," George said, "but I can't imagine what he's been doing in that white coat, unless he had to change a tire."
"I think the beard looks worse than the coat," Martha said. "Someone should tell him, because he's such a nice-looking man."
"Wait a second," George said. "Weren't we supposed to call Dr. Biddle if we saw Dr. Regis?"
"That was yesterday," Martha said. "You think it's the same today?"
"Why take a chance?" George said as he reached for the phone.
To Kim's relief, the elevator was empty when he boarded it on the ground floor, and he was able to ride solo all the way to the surgical floor. He wasn't quite as lucky on his transit of the surgical lounge. There were a number of the OR nurses and on-call anesthesiologists having coffee. Although no one said anything, those assembled eyed him with curiosity. Kim was glad to get into the surgical locker room and away from the inquiring faces. He was particularly pleased to find it vacant, and he lost no time. After rescuing his hospital ID, a few papers and pens, plus some surgical tape from the pockets, he pulled off the coat, the scrubs, and even his underwear. Everything went into the laundry hamper. Completely naked, Kim was shocked to catch his reflection in the mirror. His visage was far worse than he imagined. His ratty whiskers were significantly more than a 5 o'clock shadow, but far from being a beard. And his hair was a mess, plastered down across his forehead, yet standing straight up in the back, suggesting he'd just gotten out of bed. Opening his combination lock, Kim got out the toiletries he kept in his locker and quickly shaved. Then he got into the shower with a vial of shampoo. Kim had his head under the jet of water when he thought he heard his name called. Leaning out from the stream, but with his eyes closed tightly against the suds, he listened. Someone repeated his name. The voice was definitely more authoritative than friendly. Kim rinsed off the soap, then looked toward the shower entrance. He was in a common shower with four heads. Standing on the tiled threshold were Dr. Forrester Biddle, chief of cardiac surgery, and Dr. Robert Rathborn, acting chief of the medical staff. They made a curious pair. In contrast to Forrester's ascetic gauntness, Robert was the picture of self-indulgent obesity.
"Dr. Regis," Robert repeated when he was confident of Kim's attention. "As the current head of the medical staff, it is my duty to inform you that your hospital privileges have been temporarily revoked."
"This is a curious conversation to have while I'm in the shower," Kim said. "Or was it your specific intent to catch me naked?"
"Your glibness has never been more inappropriate," Forrester spat. "I've been warning you, Dr. Regis."
"You couldn't wait for 5 minutes?" Kim questioned.
"We felt it was important enough to inform you as soon as possible," Robert said.
"What are the grounds?" Kim asked.
"For obstructive behavior during your daughter's cardiac resuscitation attempt," Robert said. 3 doctors and 2 nurses have filed formal complaints of physical intimidation by you that precluded them from carrying out their duty.
And I am appalled at your decision to perform open-heart cardiac massage on your own daughter," Forrester said. "In my opinion, it is beyond the pale of acceptable professional behavior."
"She was dying, Robert," Kim hissed. "The closed chest massage wasn't effective. Her pupils were dilating."
"There were other qualified people on the scene," Robert said sanctimoniously.
"They weren't doing crap," Kim snapped. "They didn't know what the hell was going on. Nor did I till I got a look at her heart." Kim's voice broke and he looked away for a moment.
"There'll be a hearing," Robert said. "The issue here is whether you are a threat to patients or even yourself. You'll have an opportunity to present your side of this unfortunate episode. Meanwhile, you are not to practice any medicine within these walls, and you are specifically forbidden to do any surgery whatsoever."
"Well, it's good of you gentlemen to come into my office like this with such good news," Kim said.
"I wouldn't be so glib if I were you," Forrester warned.
"Nor would I," Robert said. "This incident and our action will be communicated to the Board of Medicine. You could very well find your medical license in jeopardy."
Kim turned around so that he could present what he thought was the most appropriate part of his anatomy to his 2 guests. Bending forward, he went back to completing his shampoo.
The El Toro bar looked like a completely different establishment in the daylight, without the red glow of the neon bull and without the lively percussive sound of the Hispanic music. The ramshackle building looked abandoned. The only evidence it wasn't were the fresh discarded beer cans scattered about the deserted parking lot. Shanahan shook his head at the miserable scene as his black Cherokee navigated the pockmarked parking area. The rainy, foggy weather didn't help as it blanketed the area with a dense pall. Shanahan pulled alongside Carlos's truck, whose condition matched the surroundings. Carlos climbed out of his truck and came around to Shanahan's driver's side window. It was heavily tinted, and Carlos could only see his own reflection until Shanahan lowered it. With no greeting and no explanation, Shanahan handed Carlos a $100 bill. Carlos looked at the money, then back at Shanahan.
"What's this?" he said. "You told me 200. The woman's been taken care of, just like we talked about."
"You messed up," Shanahan said. "It wasn't clean. We heard about the doctor. You should have done him. You knew he was there looking for the woman."
"I tried," Carlos said.
"What do you mean, tried?" Shanahan asked with derision. "You're supposed to have this great reputation with a knife. The guy was unarmed."
"I didn't have time," Carlos said. "He set off the silent alarm when he broke in, and the police got there before I could finish him. I was lucky to get rid of her blood and stuff."
"What did you do with her car?" Shanahan asked.
"It's in my cousin's garage," Carlos said.
"We'll pick it up," Shanahan said. "I don't want anybody using it. It's got to be junked."
"Nobody's going to use it," Carlos said.
"What about her phone?" Shanahan asked.
"I got that in my truck," Carlos said.
"Get it," Shanahan ordered. Dutifully, Carlos returned to his truck. A minute later, he was back at Shanahan's window. Carlos handed the cell phone to the security man. Shanahan tossed the phone onto the passenger seat.
"I hope I don't have to ask you if you made any calls."
Carlos raised his dark eyebrows innocently, but didn't respond verbally. Shanahan closed his eyes, put a hand to his forehead, and shook his head in dismay.
"Please tell me you didn't use the phone," he said through clenched teeth, although he already knew the answer.
When Carlos still didn't respond, Shanahan opened his eyes and stared, dumbfounded, at his accomplice. He tried to control his rage.
"All right, who did you call? Don't you know they'll be able to trace the call? How can you be so stupid?"
"I called my mother in Mexico," Carlos admitted guiltily.
Shanahan rolled his eyes and started to worry that he would now have to get rid of Carlos. The trouble with this kind of work was that when things started to go wrong, they had a way of quickly getting out of hand.
"But my mother has no phone," Carlos said. "I called a phone in a store where my sister works."
"What kind of store?" Shanahan asked.
"A big store," Carlos said. "It sells all sorts of things."
"Like a department store?" Shanahan asked.
"Yeah, like a department store," Carlos said.
"When did you call?" Shanahan asked.
"Last night," Carlos said. "The store is open late on Saturday night, and my mother always goes to walk my sister home."
"Where in Mexico?" Shanahan asked.
"Mexico City," Carlos said.
Shanahan felt relieved. An anonymous call to a large store in the most populous city in the world wasn't much of a lead.
"And that was the only call?" Shanahan asked.
"Yeah, man," Carlos said. "Just one call."
"Let's get back to the doctor," Shanahan said.
"Does he know what happened to the woman?"
"Probably," Carlos said. "He saw her blood."
"One way or the other, he's a threat," Shanahan said.
"He's got to go. We'll pay you the other 100, plus 300 extra to do the job. What do you say?"
"When?" Carlos asked.
"Tonight," Shanahan said. "We know where he lives, and he lives alone. It's in the Balmoral section of town."
"I don't know," Carlos said. "He's a big guy."
"With the reputation you have, I didn't think that would matter," Shanahan said.
"It's not the killing that will be hard," Carlos said. "It's getting rid of the body and the blood."
"You don't have to worry about that," Shanahan said. "Just do the trick and walk out. Maybe you can make it look like a robbery by taking money and valuables. Just don't take anything that can be traced."
"I don't know," Carlos said. "The police don't like us Mexicans driving around in the Balmoral neighborhood. I've been stopped up there."
"Listen, Carlos," Shanahan said. He was quickly losing his patience.
"You don't have a lot of choice at this juncture. You screwed up last night. As I understand it, you had plenty of time to kill the doctor. Besides,
You don't even have a green card. Carlos shifted his weight and rubbed his upper arms against the damp cold. He had no coat and was still wearing his leather vest without a shirt.
What's the address? Carlos asked with resignation.
That's more like it, Shanahan said, as he handed over a typed 3x5 card. Defying the revocation of his hospital privileges by the medical staff as delivered by Robert Rathborn, Kim went around the hospital and visited all his inpatients. He spent the most time with Friday's post-ops. As Tom Bridges had promised, he'd been following all the patients closely. Kim was pleased that all were doing well and without complications. By the time Kim left the hospital, it was mid-afternoon. Kim had considered trying to call Kelly Anderson to arrange a meeting, but then decided it would be better to just drop in. Besides, he didn't have her phone number, and he rationalized it was undoubtedly unlisted. Kelly Anderson lived in a prairie-style house in the Christie Heights section of town. It wasn't quite as upscale as Balmoral, but it was close. Kim pulled to the curb and stopped. He turned off the ignition and gazed at the house. It took him a moment to build up his courage. For Kim, coming to Kelly Anderson was akin to conniving with the devil herself. He felt he needed her, but certainly didn't like her. Kim trudged up to the front door, realizing that there was a very good chance he would not even make it across the threshold. Caroline, Kelly's precocious daughter, opened the door. For a moment, Kim could not find his voice. The child brought back the unwelcome image of Becky in the ICU. Kim heard a man's voice from inside the house, asking Caroline who was there.
"I don't know," Caroline yelled back over her shoulder. "He won't talk."
"I'm Dr. Regis," Kim managed. Edgar Anderson appeared behind his daughter. He was an academic-appearing fellow with heavy, dark-rimmed glasses. He was wearing an oversized, elbow-patched cardigan sweater. A pipe hung from the corner of his mouth.
"Can I help you?" Edgar inquired.
Kim repeated his name and asked to speak to Kelly Anderson. Edgar introduced himself as Kelly's husband and invited Kim inside. He showed him into the living room, which had the appearance of never being used.
"I'll let her know you are here," Edgar said. "Please, sit down. Can I offer you anything? Coffee?"
"No, thank you," Kim said. He felt self-conscious, as if he were a mendicant. He lowered himself onto an immaculate couch. Edgar disappeared, but Caroline stayed to stare at Kim from behind a club chair. Kim could not look at her without thinking about Becky. Kim was relieved when Kelly swept into the room.
"My, my," she intoned. "This is curious. The fox chasing the hound. Sit down, please."
Kim had gotten to his feet when she'd entered. She plopped into the club chair.
"And to what do I owe the pleasure of this unexpected visit?" she added.
"Could we speak alone?" Kim asked. Acting as if she had been unaware Caroline was in the room, Kelly told her daughter to find something entertaining to do. As soon as Caroline had left, Kim started by telling about Becky's death. Kelly's glib demeanor changed immediately. She was obviously deeply moved. Kim told Kelly the whole story, including the details of the discussions he'd had with Kathleen Morgan and Marcia Baldwin. He told her about his visit and arrest at the Onion Ring restaurant. He even told her about the harrowing episode in Higgins and Hancock, culminating in his second arrest. When Kim fell silent, Kelly exhaled and leaned back. She shook her head.
"What a story," she said, "and what a tragedy for you. But what brings you to me? I assume there is something you want me to do."
"Obviously," Kim said. "I want you to do a story about all this. It's something the public needs to know, and I want to get out the message about Marcia Baldwin. The more I think about it, the more I'm convinced there's a conspiracy here. If she's alive, the sooner she's found, the better." Kelly chewed the inside of her cheek while she pondered Kim's request. There were some intriguing elements to the story, but there were also some problems. After a few moments, she shook her head.
"Thank you for coming by and telling me all this, but I'm not interested from a professional point of view, at least not at this time."
Kim's face fell. As he'd told the story, he'd become progressively convinced of its merit, and Kelly's rapid negative decision came as a disappointing surprise.
"Can you tell me why?" he questioned.
"Sure," Kelly said. "As much as I sympathize with you about the tragic loss of your darling, talented daughter, it's not the kind of TV journalism I generally do. I go after harder, bigger stories, if you know what I mean." But this is a big story, Kim complained. Becky died of E. coli 0157H7. This has become a worldwide problem. True, Kelly admitted, but it's only one case. That's the point, Kim said. Only one case so far. I'm convinced she got it at the Onion Ring restaurant on Prairie Highway. I'm afraid she's going to turn out to be the index case of what could be a big outbreak. But an outbreak hasn't happened, Kelly said. You said yourself your daughter got sick over a week ago. If there were going to be an outbreak, there would have been more cases by now, but there haven't been. But there will be, Kim said. I'm convinced of it. Fine, Kelly said. When there are more cases, I'll do a story. I mean, one isolated case is not a story. How can I say it more clearly? But hundreds of kids die each year from this bacteria, Kim said. People don't know that. That might be true, Kelly said, but these hundreds of cases are not related. But they are, Kim said with exasperation. Almost all of them get it from ground beef. The meat industry that produces the hamburger is a threat to everyone who eats ground beef. It's a situation that has to be exposed. Hey, where have you been? Kelly asked with equal exasperation. It's already been exposed, particularly by the Jack in the Box outbreak and the Hudson meat recall. This E. coli has been in the news just about every month. It's been in the news, but the media has been giving the wrong message, Kim said. Oh, really? Kelly questioned, superciliously. I suppose that, in addition to being a cardiac surgeon, you're also a media expert. I don't profess to be a media expert, Kim said, but I do know that the media coverage of this issue has given two important false impressions. One, that the presence of this dangerous E. coli in ground meat is unusual, and two, that the USDA is on the job inspecting meat to guarantee its safety. Both these messages are false, as evidenced by the deaths of up to 500 kids a year. Whoa, Kelly commented. Now you're out on very thin ice. I mean, now you're making a couple of major accusations. How can you back it up? What kind of proof do you have? My daughter's death, Kim said with obvious anger, and the CDC's report of the other deaths. I'm talking about the accusation you made about E. coli being so common and the USDA failing to inspect the meat. I don't have specific proof right now, Kim said. That's what I expect you to find when you do the story. But so many kids wouldn't be dying if it wasn't true, and all this was substantiated by Marsha Baldwin. Ah, of course, Kelly said dubiously. How could I forget? The mysterious USDA inspector, who you say has been missing for less than 24 hours. The one you feel has fallen victim to foul play. Exactly, Kim said. They had to silence her. Kelly cocked her head to the side. She wasn't 100% sure she shouldn't be afraid of Kim, especially considering his double arrests. She had the sense his daughter's death had done something to his mind. He seemed paranoid, and she wanted him out of the house. Tell me again, Kelly said. The reason you think Miss Baldwin is missing is because of the interrupted telephone call and the blood you found in the slaughterhouse? Exactly, Kim repeated. And you told all this to the police who arrested you, Kelly asked. Of course, Kim said, but they didn't believe me. And I can see why, Kelly said silently to herself. All at once, she stood up. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.